the vault. High atop the pastoral center of the Diocese of Camden, you're listening to Talking Catholic.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Talking Catholic. I'm Jen Morrow, and with me today, as always, is Mike Walsh. Hi, Mike.
You know, last week when we started off, I actually went back and listened to the podcast and realized that I now understand why you were so confused, because depending on how you were listening to it, it sounded like I said I was abdicating my throne on the podcast and was just turning it over to you wholesale to do with other people for the remainder of time. No, that's not exactly what I was saying. I will have to be removed kicking and screaming or just fired from the podcast. But I do anticipate future podcasts where I am not the co-host all the time. So I just wanted to clear that up for anybody who was listening last week. With any luck, I'll talk less still, though it doesn't look to be the case this episode. But that was.
Did you get calls and emails asking you, Mike, you can't go anywhere from your fans?
Not a single person. I got the impression actually people were quite thrilled with the idea of me abdicating my seat on this podcast. But no, I was listening back to it. And I went, oh, that's why she was so confused. Okay, that makes a lot more sense. But there is one coming up shortly where I will not be on it. It will be a podcast with Jen and Marianella, and they will be interviewing one of the new directors of the diocese together. And I'm actually excited because that'll only be the second episode of the almost 300 we've done that I have not been
co-host on. What was the first?
We were doing one on the subject of Franciscans. There was a guy whose name, I'm going to kill myself about this because he listens to the podcast, but he was doing a documentary. He's a third order Franciscan. And mm-hmm. He was, at the time, Carrie Janice was not my co-host, but she was having him at her parish. And my co-host Pete at the time, Pete Sanchez, and she were discussing it, and I realized they were such naturals that there was no sense for me to be on the podcast that episode. So I gave my seat to Carrie, and it turned out to be sort of a training podcast because we eventually invited her on as a regular co-host. But that was the only one I ever missed. And that was, I was in the room. Actually, I didn't miss it. I was in the room. I was the one handling all the electronics, but she and Pete did the podcast themselves, and it's a great one.
You know, I think that was my biggest concern when you announced it last week, is not that you wouldn't be there, but it was the technology point. And we all know that I am a 200-year-old woman when it comes to technology. So, you know, that was my immediate, like, oh, wait, who's going to hit record? Yes, it's that simple, people. It's that simple.
I will let you know that it's not the recording process. It's the technical part. You literally press one button. It's the other stuff that gets a little more difficult, but that I will continue to have because nobody else wants that job. Mm-hmm. However, Jen, this was a lovely weekend this past weekend in the Diocese of Camden, because you got to experience something for the first time here. And I got to experience something that, that I've been able to the last 5 years, which is the ordination of new priests in the Diocese of Camden, which is one of the most joyous days in the diocese. We had five guys come in, and it was pretty wonderful.
I always call ordination day the best day to work for the Catholic Church, other than Easter, of course. But ordination day, you just know, is going to be filled with spirituality, smiles. You're going to meet tons of great people because everybody's in a good mood. But then it actually just goes so much deeper than that. And I will be honest, I just never experienced an ordination like I did this past weekend in the Diocese of Camden. Just the spirituality that was palpable in the air. Bishop Sullivan's homily, which was brought tears to my eyes. If anybody didn't get a chance to watch it on live stream, I encourage you to go to the Diocese of Camden's YouTube channel and watch the replay of the ordination mass, because the homily was just had something for everyone. It was beautiful. And then all five men got ordained priests, and the emotions on their faces, there was crying. It was just amazing. It was just, everybody was, you could just feel it. Did you feel the same way?
Well, I would like to believe I would have, had I not been the guy running the live stream at that point, and just wanted to make sure that it looked good and sounded good, because my usual compatriot on that, John Kalitz, who handles almost all of our major visual events, was on the road that day with his son at a hockey tournament in Pittsburgh. Now, I've run the live stream myself before, but never one that was quite that important and impactful. So I wanted to make sure I was getting everything done right. So all I know is that the bishop opened his mouth and words came out. I'm not entirely certain I actually retained anything that was said, but I did see all the faces, and it was a beautiful event, and it's everybody had a great time. It was standing room only, which had, I think, the first time I've been in a standing room only mass in far too long now. And it was just, it was a great event. And it was capped off, the next day, actually that night. And then the next day there were the first masses of the new priests, which in addition to the ordination is one of my favorite things to go to. So I was able to go to two of them, and they are just delightful. Sometimes they look like they are as prepared as they can. This is like they have been waiting for this moment their entire life. There's an aura of greatness around them that's sort of come down because they're so excited. And then sometimes they quite literally look like a deer in the headlights. And I got to tell you,
so.
as they should. Each of the two masses I went to, they were great. But you could see the guys were affected a little differently in both of them. But it was very authentic, and you can see how happy the families were. And, you know, they did everything right because they're smart in that first mass. They have a master's of ceremonies to make sure they don't screw up.
Yes.
It was great, but it was a wonderful weekend, genuinely.
I like that word you used, authentic, because to be fair, I was pretty busy during the ordination at the beginning, interviewing like some of the parents of the men, other mothers spoke with me, and then some family and friends in the pews. And I was having a great time interviewing them because they were relating stories about the days leading up to ordination and what their sons were thinking about. And one of the parishioners was talking about being in a parishioner where one of the men had served as a traditional transitional deacon before he's becoming a priest. So I'm just having this amazingly authentic spiritual moment. And then I glance up and you look so intense running around that church with the live stream that I was thinking, I'm having the best time right now. And he looks really busy. Oh, well.
Hey, listen, that's what I signed up for.
The live stream was great. Though, to be fair, you got me back later, whether you know you realized it or not, because I was interviewing some priests after the mass and you were finished. So you just decided to come up and jump into the conversation, at which point I was thinking, I'm in the middle of my job now.
I did think about that for a minute. And after I stopped harassing you guys for like about 10 seconds, I did walk away. You might have noticed.
You did. I appreciate that.
But I do encourage people, if you're interested, to go back and watch the live stream. It's not short, it's like almost 3 hours, but you can clip it to the parts you want to see. And then also make sure you check out Jen's article in the Catholic Star Herald, because it was really a beautiful conversation with people who had an impact into these new priests' lives. And I thought you did a good job capturing that. So make sure you read the article too. And then look at the beautiful pictures by Dave Hernandez,
Mike Walsh. We have Rich Hunley, who's kind of a new freelance photographer for our diocese. You know, I have a funny story to tell you really quick. So I also went to one of the first masses later evening, Saturday night, for Father Robbins. And after mass, one of the parishioners came up to me, poor soul, and said, "Why was this a special mass?" Like he didn't know. He must have just come to the regular 5 o'clock. And then when I told him, Father Robbins has just been ordained earlier, he's like, "I thought so. I'm so glad I came today." And then he walked out. But it was really sweet to know that somebody was there who was just, you know, not family or friends, but wanted to, you know, come into the 5 o'clock mass. Got a little something extra special.
Yeah. I tell people all the time, if you've never had the opportunity, go to an ordination mass. It's welcome. Everyone is welcome to it. This will be the last one we'll have done for a year, I think. There'll be a break next year. We'll have a transitional deacon who will be ordained, God willing. And then the year after that, we'll have another priest ordination. But they are good. And if you get a chance, go to one, because they're very, 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 very special. Genuinely very special. So, but that is not the topic of our podcast today. The topic of our podcast today is about 180 degrees in the other direction. Has to do with the service of the Catholic Church and sort of why we get into what we do and the know, the need in the world for good Catholics and people of good faith and good conscience. But we have a great conversation about a topic you've been wanting to talk about for a little while now, Jen.
Yes. So we have Dina Brick with us today, and she is senior technology. Oh, I'm going to strap that over. Dina Brick, senior technical advisor for food security and markets for Catholic Relief Services. And she also serves on the humanitarian response team. Welcome, Dina.
Hi, Jen. Hi, Mike.
Thanks for being on. For our listeners who may have tuned in a couple of weeks ago, we also had some representative from Catholic Relief Services on speaking about what Catholic Relief Services does on the local and national level and also overseas. And during some of that conversation, it was mentioned that Dina has experience on the ground in Ukraine. And with everything going on right now, we thought it would be good to hear Dina talk about some of her experiences. So this should be a great podcast. But first, I have to ask you a very important question, Dina.
Yes.
All right. So first, everybody, Dina is from New Jersey. So it's very good to have a fellow Jerseyan on the podcast. And you're from Bridgewater. Is that correct?
I am. I grew up in Bridgewater. Yes. Now I live in West Orange, Essex County. So I'm from Somerset County to Essex County.
So to bring up a issue that has been on this podcast before, is Bridgewater North Jersey, South Jersey, or Central Jersey? And is there such thing as a Central Jersey?
There's absolutely a Central Jersey, and Bridgewater is squarely in it. Although I have a friend from Hamilton, and she said, isn't that near down by you? She said that's Central Jersey, which I couldn't understand. But anyway, I'm on board.
All right. With Central Jersey. Dina absolutely can come back to the podcast. Yes.
Okay. I'm definitely outnumbered today. I'm outnumbered.
Taylor ham or pork roll. We were on the cusp. It was called Taylor ham in some diners and pork roll in the other. It was right in the middle. I think we were on the border.
See, it's good to have Jerseyans on the podcast who can talk the language. So Dina, why don't you tell us, we'll start out by having you tell us how long you've been with Catholic Relief Services and what it is that you do.
So I joined CRS in 2005. I started as a fellow, which is basically entry level coming out of graduate school. I think there's about 20 every year. And I started as a fellow in Chad, moved from there to Burundi as a program manager. And then I came to headquarters for a couple of years. I was focusing mostly on food security programs, food security and agriculture, and programs that really tried to support local markets as much as possible. And then after headquarters, the first time I lived and worked in Haiti following the earthquake in 2010. I guess I was from 2011 to 2014-ish. And then since then, I've been back on this humanitarian response team now in my current role.
You were in Haiti for that entire time after the earthquake?
I was there. I went right after the earthquake on some short-term sort of emergency surge support, and then ended up going back to live there for about 3 years, starting the following year. Yeah. So I wasn't based in Port-au-Prince, which is where the earthquake was really hit hard. The first time I was there, I was supporting Port-au-Prince, but I was in the South, which is one of the Southern departments, supporting some of CRS's work down there, which was largely a lot of agriculture and food security kind of programming.
Wow. I can only imagine not only what you went through, but the on-site training that you learned. I mean, you can't learn that unless you live it.
That was sort of every step in my career at CRS has been like that. Yeah. It's coming with some kind of knowledge and being quickly humbled by what I don't know and what people that I meet have to teach me and what people, you know, local people have to bring. It's humbling every day, I would say.
Sorry, I interrupted. So after Haiti?
That's when I joined the humanitarian response team, which is what I'm part of now. And so that team is a surge, like a humanitarian surge team. I think there's about 80 people on it right now. CRS is in over 100 countries, and usually have their own country programs and country offices. And the humanitarian surge team comes in when country office is overwhelmed, or whether there's a larger emergency that needs some support, or whether they need some sort of specialized technical support. So I lead a team of people that focus on food security and livelihoods programs, and also programs that support local markets or any kind of cash-based programming, cash transfer programming, or other kinds of programs that try to support local markets. So my team and I deploy in those kinds of situations, in often in rapid onset emergencies, like something that happens suddenly, but also could be in sort of slower onset, like drought, or, you know, emergencies or crises that kind of build over time, and it's where country offices or partners need additional support.
So you recently returned from Ukraine. Do I understand that right? Or you've been recently in Ukraine?
I was in Moldova, actually, which is one of the refugee accepting countries right outside of Ukraine. I was there right at the start of the war, which, gosh, is now, I think, in its 10th week or something, right? It was the end of February into March. I was there as part of our surge team. We are supporting, for the most part, in that within Ukraine and then also in the surrounding countries. CRS is mostly supporting a local organization, the Caritas organizations, that are there doing it. You know, they're in it. They were supporting people from day one. And CRS, I was there in Moldova, both supporting the Caritas team and also some of the CRS teams. And Caritas there is doing, we're supporting refugees coming across the border and providing food and hygiene, access to accommodation, access to cash so they can buy whatever they need there or continue with transportation or going to other countries. There's still, as you can imagine, the work kind of changes every day as the situation is changing, but the need is enormous currently.
You know, just as a point of reference, what is the relationship like? What's the nature of the relationship between Caritas and CRS? I think a lot of times people hear Catholic Charities, they hear Catholic Relief Services, and they hear Caritas. And I think sometimes people think that they're interchangeable, but they're actually three different organizations.
Yeah, Catholic Charities is the domestic arm. CRS is the international arm of the USCCB. And I think of CRS as sort of Caritas US. There's a Caritas Internationalis, which is based in Rome. And then a lot of different countries will have their own Caritas offices. So as much as possible, it's within CRS's mandate to really work as local as possible, right? So as much as possible, we try to be supporting the local organizations that are already there on the ground, that know best how to support their own people or people coming in and out of their countries. So our real mandate is to work through Caritas and other local organizations, but Caritas is really a priority partner. And CRS is the largest of any of the Caritas organizations. So it sometimes is seen as a donor even, although we have a lot of implementing, I mean, the majority of our work is really as an implementing partner. But yeah, we do a lot of support of Caritas. And the Caritas organizations inside Ukraine, as well as in the surrounding countries, are really motivated, really, really strong. I think of inside Ukraine, I was just reading that they, with CRS support, they have reached over 1 million people.
Wow.
I mean, that's a fraction of the need, but it's really impressive anyway.
Let's go back and talk about a little bit of your time in Moldova in terms of the rapid response. So what happened? Like, where were you prior to Moldova, and how quickly were you geared up for Moldova? And then how long did it take you to get set up in Moldova?
I was here in West Orange, and then 2 days later on a plane. they had already, CRS already actually had an office in Moldova, and Caritas Moldova has been working for a while also. For Caritas Moldova, it was a real shift. It's not an emergency country. For CRS, it is not an emergency program. It was the Orphans and Vulnerable Children Support Program. So the nature of the program, the scope, the scale was way beyond, you know, what their local capacity is. So we, another surge people, got on a plane and got over there. So there already was some infrastructure on the ground. That's not always the case, depending on the emergency. And quite quickly, the Caritas team and also the CRS team there was able to sort of pivot the work they were already doing. Caritas was already working with within some of its diocese with some centers that quickly became refugee accommodation centers that they were started to bring in hot meals. The Caritas team with CRS support got linked up with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, to start and provide this big cash program, actually. And then with the UN World Food Program is sort of linked up to be providing some assistance to host families. One of the amazing things I saw there, actually, which still I'm just still amazed by, is this incredible outpouring of support by the Moldovan population. You know, these are neighbors, right? They've never met any of them before, but people were just opening their homes, you know, welcoming everybody. They were literally driving to the border and picking people up and letting them stay in their homes and feeding them and getting them on buses to, if they were going to continue on to Romania, or kind of help them find assistance within Moldova. I mean, the outpouring of support that I saw there was really amazing. You know, I think about it a lot, about sentiment in the US, even about immigrants, you know, and just thinking about how it was just a really, really incredible to see this openness, you know, people really seeing their neighbors, you know.
Yeah. Now, I know I've heard a few stories from some of our religious women who went in Diocese of Camden, who served in, or, you know, who went to volunteer in Poland. And they've been seeing like women and children getting off trains with bags full of clothes and canned foods, you know, whatever they have. Was that some of these similar scenes that you saw in Moldova?
I did. And, you know, it was interesting. In the very beginning, there were people that were coming across in their own cars, in their own vehicles, probably ones that were lived close to the border and saw things. Maybe they had the means and they knew people outside and they could pass through. But as the war progressed, at least even during the time that I was there, the people that I saw were coming with fewer things, you know, and I was seeing people that had just, you know, one woman was there with her mother and her daughter. And she said, "We just grabbed this," you know, they had one bag, they had thrown stuff in their bag and just got into the first transportation they could, because the bombing was happening right next door to them suddenly. And, you know, people that I met were, you know, they're incomplete families, right? They couldn't bring their husbands, they couldn't bring their sons, their brothers, because they all have to stay behind to fight. So the majority of refugees that I met anyway were women and children. A lot of elderly, although I was hearing stories of some elderly that weren't able to move even, you know, it's harder for them to find transportation. And
And
I mean, that made the welcome of the Moldovans all the more important, that people, no one ever wants to be from their home, I can imagine, you know.
Yeah.
And just seeing that there were people that were waiting to help them, I think was really powerful. People also mentioned they were grateful for the internet, you know, they could talk to their husbands back in Odessa or whatever, because they were actually able to, you know. And it was interesting too, meeting like some people that I met. There was a family that I met in one of the towns that had been there probably the longest. It was, they'd come from Kharkiv, which is one of the first places to be bombed, which actually now, just the other day I was reading, is now back in Ukrainian hands. But At the time, it was one of the first areas to be bombed, and they were the longest staying people at the time at that accommodation center, because for the most part, people were kind of coming and they didn't want to be in Moldova either. You know, they were trying to find, they had family somewhere else, but this family literally had nowhere to go, you know, and that was not an uncommon thing to hear, you know. And these were like some NGOs that had kind of converted their space. This was a high school, actually, that was, the students were out for spring break, I think, or Easter break or winter break or something. And so even for those 2 weeks, they were putting people in rooms, and it was all staffed by volunteers, or if they were able to get some additional funding. But yeah, people were really in this state of deciding if they were going to stay. A lot of people were still hopeful that the war was going to be over really soon, that they could go right back. We know now that that is not the case, although some people are able to go back, and I think probably are taking advantage of as soon as they can to try to go back, you know?
Yeah.
Some people were trying to find relatives further on in Europe, and so we're kind of passing through. And then there were, yeah, just a large number of people that just didn't have anywhere else to go. That's still the case. Yeah.
That begs the question. I'm willing to bet that most Americans have either never heard of Moldova, or if they have very little perception of what Moldova is. Can you give a little explanation of that country and, you know, the look and feel, what the people are like?
Yeah, you know, I'd heard of it, and I'd never been there either. so this was also my first glimpse of it. It's not technically EU, but it's one of the poorest countries in that region, in quote unquote Europe, I guess, you know, but that area. Mm-hmm. So they already don't have a ton of resources, but, you know, I was talking to a friend later who was in the Peace Corps there, and he said, I was just telling him about my experience and my impressions there. And he said, you know, I'm not surprised from what I saw. It was just a real culture of welcome and openness. People feeding you way too much, kind of, and, you know, making sure you have what you need. And there's an NGO that I went to visit. We were trying to support, as I mentioned before, like trying to support as local as possible. You know, we met a couple of NGOs that were just incredible, like pivoting their work. I think they'd been providing hair cutting and some basic services for the elderly and some youth services. And they immediately pivoted and became this refugee accommodation center. And they, the volunteers there were saying this elderly 80 something year old woman had like walked all the way from her home, and she brought a dozen eggs from her garden, you know, like people didn't have very much of anything, and they were bringing everything they had, you know. It was, it was really, really amazing. Otherwise it felt, I don't know, it was a strange experience in a way too, because I had, for example, been in Greece during the Syrian crisis when there were lots of refugees passing through. And there, I was not out on the Greek islands. If you remember, people were crossing and were coming to the islands, right? Mm-hmm. But I was in Athens, and there were still people all over the place, like on the streets and just trying to find places to go. And there was lots of movement and kind of chaos, especially in the early days. But I didn't see any of that in Moldova. And it turns out that the majority of the refugees passing through were staying with somebody. So whether it's somebody that they knew already or somebody that they found and just opened their homes to them. But it wasn't the same dynamic as it was, at least from what I saw with the European crisis in the past. And it was cold, you know, this was the end of February, March.
Yeah.
Some of the host families I talked to were saying, we're okay for now, but we're going to need some money for fuel. Eventually we might need some money for food. So that was sort of the genesis also of some of the programs now that are supporting these host families and providing some cash assistance so that they can continue to house people in the short or the medium term while people kind of sort out what they're doing.
I think that brings up a good point. And it's something that we spoke with Catholic Relief Services on the previous podcast is you're on the ground to work with the local community. It's not like, you know, here come the saviors. You know, you're there to be part of the community and support local as much as possible. So if there's others out there right now looking at Ukraine saying, what can we do? Do you have any recommendations? I mean, I know a lot, sometimes people want to send care packages and things, but how does that play into versus being able to, you know, have the money just to buy local, support local industry during this war?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, I mean, the organizations on the ground, they either pivoted really quickly to be supporting or it was something that they were doing already. I think donations to them or to organizations like the Caritas that's working there or CRS or others that are on the ground is the best way. I love and appreciate the donation drives and things like that, that are trying to send stuff overseas. But honestly speaking, the easiest and the most efficient way of providing assistance is through direct donations. And the reason is that one of the reasons is that that enables those local organizations to also support the local economies, right? So that they can be buying those goods locally or as close as possible. You know, it is true that in Ukraine, there are some places where shelves are empty, but like CRS and Caritas have brought in about 1,000 metric tons of supplies from Poland, you know, so at least as local as possible, kind of supporting those local economies as much as possible. And that's actually sort of the same philosophy, I guess. And in my work, we promote where it's appropriate. And they're doing quite a bit of this actually in the Ukraine response, is providing cash assistance to refugees and to displaced people. So Caritas Ukraine is providing cash assistance among other things within Ukraine. And it was the same in Moldova, where people are providing, it can be like meals and hygiene supplies and accommodation in kind. But there's a pretty large cash program there now, which is providing, I think it's $120 a person, which is intended to cover about a month of whatever. And the reason for that is that, you know, we as humanitarians can never pretend to know what everybody needs at any given time, right? Everyone is going to have a variety of different needs. And so one, helping or kind of empowering people to be able to buy and purchase whatever they need. Do they need to rent a room for a couple of nights? Do they need clothing for their kids? Do they need food? It also can promote the local economy, especially one that has been crunched significantly with COVID in the past couple of years. So, you know, to be able to support these local businesses. Mm-hmm. And third, which I think is probably the most important, is it's a really dignified way, I think, of recognizing that these are people that have been, you know, their powers of decision-making have been taken from them. And so being able to enable them the ability to make decisions for their families with as much flexibility as they can, you know, if they would like to stay somewhere else or to be eating something else or whatever special needs that they have. It's a really powerful way, I think, of really promoting people's dignity in a time when they probably can really use that.
Absolutely.
That is one of the best explanations I have ever heard, because we get this a lot. And as in my role as a communications person, I often have had to reach out to people and say, you know, that drive you want to do is not really the best way to handle this. We actually had a problem in New Jersey. You may be aware of that, when we were housing a lot of Afghanis after the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan. And there were dozens of these drives to get clothes and furniture and stuff for the Afghans who were at Fort Dix. And the truth of the matter was that they weren't able to use most of it. So it ended up becoming more problematic than it was if it had just been a simple donation. So I'll be honest, I've been saying this for the better part of a couple of years now, donate cash. donate cash to a trusted entity. There's a lot of fly-by-night people that I can't recommend, but a trusted entity like CRS or you know, any of the other ones that exist, you know, that are governed well and have their accounting out there, you should absolutely consider your money safe with them.
Yeah, and I love the enthusiasm. Don't get me wrong. I love that people are really, I mean, yeah. The response to this crisis has been overwhelming and humbling, you know, in a really amazing way. So I really do appreciate that. But I think you're right, Mike. I think channeling that in a way that can be used efficiently and in a way that best can meet people's needs and support the local economies around them is ultimately probably the best way to go.
And your third point was spot on. And it's what I hadn't considered in the past, but I will absolutely add to my list of reasons why you should donate money, which is giving people the opportunity to feel whole again and feel normal again by being able to make their own decisions. That's a fantastic way of describing that. So if I got nothing else out of this podcast, thank you for that, Dina. I needed that third quarter. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. When we're talking about using those funds to buy food on scene, what exactly is food security? I know that's part of your title too. Can you explain that a little bit for our listeners? I think they might just think it's going to the store and making sure you have food on the table, but is it more than that?
It is more than that. It can be quite complex, actually. And at the risk of nerding out a little bit, the way that
humanitarians discuss. We like that. You nerd out all you want. We're fans.
The way that humanitarians would describe food security is in four parts. There's access, there's availability, there's utilization, and there's stability. So access is economic access. I have the money to go somewhere and buy food. It can be social access. I am a woman and I am welcome at this marketplace. Availability would be there is food available in the shops or there is food physically in my fields. Utilization is really the health and nutrition side of it. So that my body can actually use the nutrients and the micronutrients that this food provides. If I'm sick and I have all the food in the world, it won't help me to be healthy and food secure. And stability just means that it's not just right this one meal today, but that I have this in the future, that I have access to this in a steady way. So what I find helpful about that framework or that definition is that, you know, I think about places now that are really facing severe hunger, and it's often not a lack of availability of food. There's usually enough food around. It's some kind of political access issue, or some other access issue that is preventing the majority of the population from having enough food. So it's helpful to think of it, I think, that it's not just one monolithic thing, you know, that there's all these different, and even within each of those four things, there's a million, you know, components, as you can imagine. But yeah, I think it's helpful to think about that, because all of the things that are driving these food insecure situations today, it's just very complicated and kind of interconnected. There's also another thing that I've been hearing lately about what are some of the drivers of hunger or acute food insecurity. Mm-hmm. Over the past couple of years, people have been talking about, let me see if I get these, there's three C's: conflict, climate, and COVID. So conflict meaning, obviously, if there's conflict, you may not be able to access your field, or politically might have some barriers to accessing food. Climate being the increased frequency of droughts, of flooding, and then COVID meaning this economic crunch that we've all experienced, and that is even tighter or harder for people who are already living hand to mouth, and then suddenly there was economic shutdown. Mm-hmm. And then what I'm hearing now is they're adding a fourth C, which is cost. So in addition to those three C's, now with the Ukraine crisis and all the increasing costs of food, of fuel, that's sort of another driver of hunger, really.
Yeah, I remember, you know, of course, I'm sure we all have. We've all been reading articles because we've been seeing our prices go up here, of course, domestically. But we all know that, you know, food and gas prices are going up in a lot of different countries. In certain areas, I think wheat, sunflower oil. Like, can you talk a little bit about, you know, why this is happening? Why certain products above others? Why is this the Russian Ukraine affecting that? How?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that we're seeing it here, right? That suddenly our gas prices are super high, and everyone's seeing that, and everyone's seeing it also in supermarkets. It's really the same dynamic that I'm seeing in our work overseas too. The increased wheat prices, and then the prices also of substitute grain. So for example, if there's a ton of demand for wheat that you can't get that anymore, then people are demanding these substitutes. And so the prices of those are higher. Fuel prices, so that's making the whole supply chain more expensive. Edible oils like sunflower oil, 75% of sunflower oil comes from Ukraine and Russia.
How much percent?
75%.
Oh, wow.
And that's a big part of, so it's both, it both has impacts for countries that are dependent on imports, but also for countries that are dependent on food aid, because a big portion of the UN World Food Program's food traditionally has consisted of Russian wheat and also sunflower oil. So now, and then in addition to the costs of fuel that are much higher for transportation of those kinds of goods, mm-hmm. So for example, now the costs of food aid are like double of what they were in the past, meaning that now people that are managing those programs have to make really hard decisions about where to, like, do you meet, are you able to reach fewer people? Do you have to cut the ration sizes, which is what I'm hearing a lot of. So yeah, it's, you know, it's just the dynamics that we're seeing here are also playing out in these other countries in just really difficult ways. And what I'm seeing too is that countries that were kind of already on the border of facing really extreme hunger, what this Ukraine crisis is doing is kind of pushing some of them over the edge. You know, there's countries like Ukraine, Afghanistan, Yemen, South Sudan, Sudan that are always really struggling and now are having even harder times to meet the needs of people in those countries. So yeah, it's really a global crisis. It's crazy to think this is a war that's literally across the world from these countries, you know, and the impact that it's having.
Right. It's also, I mean, you know, I have the benefit of being able to speak to you face to face, so I can see the look on your face and your eyes, right? So I'm thinking, like, we're watching this on the news. You know, we're watching this war take place in real life. You have been there and then you come back. Are you, like, spiritually or personally just torn a little bit because you want to be in two places at once? Like, how does that affect you personally, if you don't mind me asking? Because, like what I said, when I hear you telling these stories, I can see you, like, reliving it just by seeing your face. Trust me, listeners, that is the look on her face. Like, how do
you... Your listeners are lucky. They don't want to see me.
Right? No, it's just, it's moving. Like, how does that affect you personally? You don't mind me asking.
You know, it's on a personal level, I've been doing this kind of work for a long time. And, you know, you've probably heard this before, but I feel like the moment it does not affect me is the moment I should not be doing it anymore. Mm-hmm. And I became a mother 4.5 years ago, and that also changed the way I view disasters and the work that I do. I've always had empathy, but it's a different story. I remember that I think the first deployment I did after I had my first son, Noah, was to Mozambique after Cyclone Idai struck. And I remember thinking it was just a very different experience seeing moms and their babies and their little children, and suddenly I could just feel it in a different way.
Yeah.
And being in Moldova, where they're all women and children, at least, you know, the vast majority were women and children, it was just a really, I don't know, it makes me grateful that I'm able to do this work and have that perspective and be inspired by these people. But yeah, it's a hard thing to be talking to women and children and knowing that mine are safe and that they're across the world and they hopefully, knock on wood, will never have to see something like this, you know. But yeah, I'm sure that's what these women thought 2 years ago, you know. I don't know. Yeah, it is hard to go back and forth and come back here, and we're in privileged places, you know. It's a good reminder of, I don't know, it's a good call to action, I guess, and a good reminder of what we have, I guess.
Yeah,
probably also a good reminder of how fragile it all is as well. You know, we've seen the ripple effects of Ukraine. We've started, and you know, lost in some of this, and for reasons that I think are pretty understandable. You know, the Russian people are going through a lot now too, with all the sanctions that are going on in Russia. And then you see what the countries surrounding Ukraine have had to do by absorbing all these refugees. I haven't seen a hard number yet. I know early on it was around 5 million. Then I saw some later numbers that were showing as many as 10 million refugees out of Ukraine. So I'm not entirely certain which is accurate now. But, you know, all those people have to go somewhere. And I know some of them are filtering back into the country, but not many. I mean, this is an occasion that's going to have ripple effects for decades.
And it's
something where we are used to seeing out of the Middle East, and we're used to seeing out of Africa, and certainly out of South America. Certainly, for years now we've heard about the refugees coming to the southern border of the United States. These concepts aren't unusual, but just not as public and as, or let me rephrase that, not as well covered as this one is, which is, I think it's why it's bringing so much more attention. I have to imagine in some ways, Dina, it's not too dissimilar to other events that have happened around the country, or around the world rather.
That I've taken part in.
Yeah.
Or I've been aware of. I mean, and it's very foundation. The things that I see that have been similar, I guess, one thing that I've seen in a number of different places is the incredible resilience of people. And the incredible humanity of people that are reaching out to support. So while the contexts are really different, I guess it is not unusual these days, unfortunately, to have a war where there are people fleeing and where there's refugees and internally displaced people. In fact, there are more of them in the world now than there have been in human history.
Yeah.
That unfortunately is not unusual anymore. But I think just seeing again, seeing people that are afraid, that don't want to be outside of their countries, that want to be home, and are really just looking for a safe place, are looking for some assurance that they and their children are going to be okay, are looking for to be treated with dignity, to be asked questions, and to be kind of responded, get responses that will help them make the decisions that they want to be making for their families as they're moving to the next place, or deciding whether, you know, people now are deciding, like, do I stay and enroll my kids in school here in this place that's not Ukraine, you know, or are going home, or, you know, decisions that we would never want to have to make for our families they're having to make. And I've not been in a million crises, but in some of the other displacement settings that I've been in anyway, those are also similar decisions that people have to make.
I think another, I just popped into my head when you were talking about, you know, the food insecurity and some of these NGOs or organizations having to make the choice whether to ration food or to send food at all. That I feel like one of the consequences or fears of that could also be when people are desperate for food, you know, that's when corrupt governments can step in and, you know, take advantage of that. And the next thing you know, goes back to your four C's, we have conflict again, you know, because when the people are hungry, and in other words, when any country is in crisis, it leaves open the possibility for corruption. Or so I feel like that, you know, that's another concern as this conflict continues.
Yeah, and the role of government is always a challenging one too. I mean, ideally an NGO wouldn't really step in unless the government can't, or, you know, the government is the first line of defense or the first line of support for their citizens. So NGO or UN really doesn't step in unless invited by the government or asked to, or if the government declares a state of emergency or physically cannot, you know, or is totally overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, on the corruption, that's sort of always a risk, I think.
Right.
But I think what you're saying is like, as people get more desperate, right?
Yeah.
And what are the choices that people, including governments, are forced to make? Yeah. I don't have any examples that I can speak to about that, but it's definitely true that as situations get more desperate, then the decisions that people make just are equally desperate, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think the podcast has been very informative for everybody who's been curious about, you know, what's going on by somebody who's actually been there. So thank you for being on and sharing with us. We really appreciate that. And as well as some tips about maybe how to get some money and dignity to the Ukrainian people and the refugees.
Yeah, thank you. I'm grateful to be able to share with you guys. Thanks for
and Dina, if people do want to support CRS and its work, where can they go? What can they do?
The CRS website, CRS.org, has all the donation information and also lots of places to learn about other work that CRS is doing. Probably can steer you also to local partners, but that's the best place to go.
And now this is going to sound like an odd question with 2 minutes left. If people want to work at CRS, what kind of people is CRS looking for?
CRS is so diverse. There is, I think if you heard from my colleagues a couple of weeks ago, there's sort of a US domestic focus. And then there's a big group of overseas people, and then an even bigger group of local national staff.
Mm-hmm.
So there's such a diversity of skills and jobs. My path came from international relations. That was my path, which kind of led me straight overseas. There are business development people that work on fundraising. There are advocacy people that support advocacy on the Hill, US government advocacy. There are a lot of church relations people. There's a diversity, I would say, probably everyone listening to this.
yeah.
There's data scientists, there's like finance officers, treasury, monitoring and evaluation. And there's actually a well-stocked job list at all times, both for domestic positions as well as overseas positions, increasingly telecommute positions, which may be interesting for some people.
Right.
As everyone's learning how we can do this remotely.
So anybody interested in possibly working with CRS or even donating time and being part of those local chapters, go to crs.org.
Right.
Dina, thank you so much again for being on the podcast. Again, very informative and heartfelt. So thanks again.
Yeah, thanks so much.
All right. I think that's it. Mike, you want to take us out?
Yeah, I hope everybody enjoyed it, and have a great week, everybody. Talk to you guys later.